Leadership is taking people on a journey where there's a vision, guidance, and purpose.
Good leaders lead with the heart as well as the head.
Leadership means doing the right thing for the right reason, no matter how difficult it might be.
You're listening to Leadership Unwrapped, a podcast where you will hear from people who are living leadership every day.
Well, Niamh, it was really interesting to talk to Linda Crockett today, and I hope the listeners will get a lot from it. I've been following Linda for many years. I've seen her work in workplace bullying. She's been a sort of a leading person internationally in pushing the agenda about raising the awareness of workplace bullying. So it was brilliant to finally get to connect with her and to do an interview. And a lot of what she says resonates with the work that we've done together over the mm-hmm. years in relation to this, and the work that I've also done with Margaret around really just trying to challenge the assumptions that we have about bullying. I think Linda is really pushing us forward in that direction internationally.
She really is, and she really, what struck me talking to her is how many different angles she's coming at this with. You know, there's the writing, the research around it, but there's also all the practical work that she's doing, and there's the work in support of the victims, and then also the work to help the perpetrators to come out of this way of of working or of behaving. So there's so many different angles that she's coming at this significant issue with. And I think that's what we need to be doing more of.
Yeah, I think she's really inspiring because she's experienced it herself and she's very open about that when she talks to us. But then she works with people who have engaged in bullying as well as supporting those who are actually targets of it. And so a lot of people, when they experience the devastation of it, don't have the sort of generosity of spirit to say, I'm going to help somebody who actually engages in this behaviour, because we're left with so much anger and devastation, not only in our work, but in our lives. But she's so genuinely committed to this that she's doing it as much as she possibly can to raise the agenda and improve the behaviours. She's tough and she's amazing in that space. And I loved that about her.
And she also talks about that as being a process very openly as well. You know, after she experienced it, you know, she's saying that, of course, it was really difficult to think of engaging with bystanders or engaging with bullies because of the hurt that she'd been through, but that you have to deal with your own. And she's very explicit about that as well. If you're to engage in this space, that you have to work through your own stuff in this area before you can kind of jump in head first with the helping on the opposite side.
It's really important to me that we do this kind of conversation, because I just feel so passionately about how much bullying destroys people's lives and how important it is that we continue to raise awareness about that, because sometimes we talk about it and you'd hear it in the media and then it goes missing and quiet again and then it comes up again. But in the times when it's going missing and quiet, it's still happening and people's lives are still getting ruined by it. So, and organizations are still tolerating it. So it's really good to do this work, and it leads into maybe some of the work we're going to be doing in the coming month.
Yeah, so on the 18th of October, Judy Carmody has organised a workplace bullying awareness event. Well, so it's Workplace Bullying Awareness Week that Linda set up, and Linda's going to be there joining us as well, which is fantastic. And Judy is organising the event that's hosted by Ireland on the Wednesday. So we're going to be there, and we're hoping that you'll have enjoyed this conversation. And if you're interested in hearing more about it, you're more than welcome to join us. It's going to be on 4 to 6, and we're going to be sharing some of the links on our social media. So you'll see if you'd like to register.
Yeah, perfect. And we'll put it in the show notes as well, so people can connect to it when this is released. Yeah.
Brilliant. Yeah.
So listeners, we hope you get some support from listening to this and a very important topic. Enjoy.
Our guest today is international keynote speaker and author Linda Crockett, founder of an award-winning resource that serves Canadian employees and employers since 2011. She's a pioneer, an activist, an advocate, and an international expert on workplace psychological harassment. She offers a holistic perspective and believes that all parties need a safe, supportive, confidential, trauma-informed resource, offering a personal and professional experience and skills to address what is a very complex and systemic issue. Linda's a trauma therapist specialising in addressing the human experience of workplace harassment, both physical and psychological. And she's worked with a range of people, including nurses, paramedics, firemen and women, police officers, teachers, social workers, oil and gas industries, medical teams, insurance companies, and a lot more. She's the founder of the Canadian Institute of Workplace Harassment and Violence. And Linda, you have described this as the most important, most rewarding and meaningful work that you have ever done. So a heartfelt welcome to you. We're also very passionate about this issue. So we're just really looking forward to chatting with you today. Thanks for making the time. And I probably should have said you're coming all the way from Canada today to talk to us.
Thanks for having me. It's lovely to talk to you.
So, Linda, usually we start by saying, tell us why this and how you've ended up doing the work that you're doing, just to give us a flavor of your journey. So can we start there?
Sure. It's because I went through it. I was a social worker before. So my first career was I was a bachelor social worker, and I'd been in all kinds of areas. So I dealt with all kinds of abuse. We can get our hands into many, many areas. So I did domestic violence, sexual abuse, child abuse, addiction, sexual, all of it. Right. And at one point in my career, I was even a supervisor who trained investigators to assess abuse. And so I knew all about walking through the systems, the medical systems, the mental health systems, the criminal justice system. I knew what abuse was. Mm. But I was at my career part where I wanted to, you know, really stay put and stop moving around. I was ready to invest and have some roots. And I took a job in a cancer center. That's a job you choose. That's not a job you take unless you want to work with that area. So I was good at grief and loss. I was good at supporting families. And at the very same time, my mother was terminally ill with cancer as well. So it was really a good choice for me at that time. And about a year into it, I started to get, just around the time she died is when I started to get bullied. So it was when I was at my most vulnerable. Mm. And I was very, very confused about what was that? What was going on? Because it didn't make sense. And nobody talks about bullying. This is back in 2008. Nobody talks about bullying. Nobody trained us about workplace bullying. I had no idea what the signs were. So I was very, very confused. And I'm also very stubborn, tenacious Scott. So I stuck it out. And 2 years into it, I ended up with a diagnosis of PTSD. Oh, wow. Not many psychiatrists or psychologists or medical doctors were actually putting that on a piece of paper. So that was very rare. And I was very, very ashamed that I could be bullied because of my skills, my background. I didn't want to admit it. So I went into isolation and I shrunk and I became this shell of myself. And I was your typical target, right? Because I was very dedicated. I was very hardworking. I loved my job. I was very confident. But by the time this was finished, you know, this was a mobbing group, by the way. I was bullied by a psychologist, a social worker, a pastor, two HR, and an admin wow. supervisor. So there was a group wow. of them. And it was like, every day I wasn't sure who was going to punch me psychologically that day, right? So I shrunk to a shell of who I was. And it was in my office one day that I realized that this silence, this is actually feeding them. This is actually building them up. I'm not, you know, there's doctors out there that misdiagnose. There's doctors out there that miss symptoms in their own children. There's police officers that own children get arrested. I've got to stop feeling ashamed and I've got to start speaking up. And I looked around and I couldn't find another social worker in the world that had spoke up about being bullied. And I thought, well, I'm going to get loud and I'm not going to shut up. So that's what I did. So, you know, I had to do my recovery first, of course.
Of course.
And I know what that looked like. But I mean, I was so sick. I was on the edge of that bridge ready to jump any day. I mean, I was really sick. But I did my recovery and then I got my master's degree specializing in this area. I went out to the United States, got trained by Dr. Gary Namy, who has his own institute in the USA. And I didn't feel that was enough. I just kept going. I joined the International Association of Workplace Bullying and Harassment. Mm-hmm. And then I became a trauma therapist so that I could, you know, truly feel like I was being responsible enough and qualified enough to help these vulnerable people. And I had to heal a lot of different parts of me as an ongoing basis, you know, like how I looked at the respondents, for example, I used to hate them. How I looked at witnesses, I used to hate them because I was hurt. But as I healed and I started to realize, no, we need services for everyone out there. We can't remove bullying without having services for leaders, for targets, for witnesses, and for the respondents.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Linda, because I think it's like those feelings that you're describing and that journey from the start of when it started happening you to where you are now, I think is the path that people tend to follow. You know, that feeling of kind of shame is the first thing I think that kicks in. So thank you for sharing that. But there was something, if I could just jump back a little bit, you said you were the typical kind of victim of bullying. Will you tell us a little bit more about what you mean by that?
Well, at the time, I certainly didn't know that. I mean, at the time, I think like a lot of people think that it was like stereotypical childhood bullying. I thought, oh, gee, I was weak. I was meek. What was it? What was wrong with me? But actually, it's the opposite. It is the ones that are skilled, that are talented, that are ethical. So in the last 12 years, I've been able to do my own kind of, you know, I've seen thousands of different targets, and I've seen every profession, every culture, all ages, you name it, from backgrounds, wherever they're from. And they all fit this one criteria. Every single one of them. It's just really uncanny how much every single one fits it. And if I could hire them, I would hire 98% of those thousands that I've seen, because they are like an employer's dream, because they go above and beyond the call of duty. They are ethical. They're skilled. They're well-liked. They are, you know, most of them love their job and they just want to do a good job. They just want to do their job. And that everybody fits that criteria. Now, there's a couple of subcategories that I would add into that, but everybody fits that criteria. So then I realized it's actually the opposite. It's the strong, it's the skilled. And that just leads us into, well, why do people bully, right? So there's many different types there too.
Yeah. And it's quite difficult, I think, to begin to accept, I need to talk up, I need to speak. It takes huge courage to do it. It's because you're naming, because it puts us into this place of saying, you know, there's no smoke without a fire. There must be something. Why is it me? People will believe it, even though I know it's not true. I've been there myself. So, and that fear that people will say, God, you know, maybe there is something there that person is, there's a problem with that person, or they are incompetent or whatever it is. But then just calling, taking courage to just call into that space and say, no, this is what's being done. It's not what is really happening in terms of the work is good. The work is professional. The work is really strong. It's not what other people want to say about it. But it requires a courage to just open up that space and the trust actually that people will see beyond the behavior. Yeah. And that feels risky, I think, for people.
Well, I don't blame people for feeling risky, you know, so I'm always promoting the need for mandatory training in this area. That's prevention. And we want to prevent harm, right? So most people come to me when they're already severely injured. We want to get to them long before they're severely injured. And they're severely injured because half the time it's happening right in front of their faces and they don't really, you know, it's normalized. They don't see it because it's happening and it's just been so normal. Secondly, they don't know what to do. Third, they don't feel supported or safe. And they've also seen everybody else come forward and get harmed even further. So why the heck are they going to stand up for it? So first of all, we need to make training mandatory, and not just training on policies and procedures, because that's not enough. Mm-hmm. That tick in the box, I met the criteria of legislation, is not enough. We need to be talking from a trauma-informed perspective, because we're talking about workplace bullying, which is a psychological hazard, a psychological injury. It's psychological harassment, it's psychological violence, there's a psychological component. So naturally, there has to be trauma-informed training. It doesn't mean that leaders in HR and investigators or mediators or even, you know, safety officers, they don't have to be psychologists, but they have to have an understanding of the psychological injury. So they're identifying it correctly and not making more mistakes and therefore causing more harm. Right. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, even a lot of therapists are not even trauma informed, you know, and people assume that they are, but they're not. So people do need to become trauma informed in this area. Then they've got language to identify it. Sorry about that. But they've got some language to identify what's happening in front of them. And they can, it's like waking up and saying, actually, that's not okay. I've been dealing with letting that go for years. No, it's not okay. And have some language to deal with it. Then you hear that this is not normal anymore. This is unacceptable. More people get some courage that way. More people come forward that way. And that's creating change, right? So I see mandatory training But you also need very good resources available for when that awakening happens and they realize, oh my God, I'm being bullied, or that's what I'm witnessing, or I am a bully. You need some good resources ready for that.
Yeah, I'm really glad to hear you saying what you're saying. I think that's the first piece. And because one of the challenges is for the person who's experiencing bullying and those around them, either what I can see from my own research, will either engaged in a kind of a helpful helplessness, oh, that's desperate, that's terrible, you need to mind yourself, but we'll still sit and watch it happening and do nothing. And that causes such devastation when the person is in the space saying, why is nobody speaking up or saying, why is it left to me to do it myself? And that causes a hurt on top of hurt in terms of the relationships of around the person. So if we're more trauma aware, maybe we can challenge a bit of the bystanding piece. Well, I guess that's what I'm thinking as you're talking.
When I train this topic, I talk about the bystander experience as well. So I talk about the profile of a target and I talk about all the different injuries for a target. But I also talk about why bystanders don't speak up. And I think we need to understand that there's a lot of very, very valid reasons for why they don't speak up. And sometimes it's because they've seen the process fail time and time again. So why the heck are they going to take a risk? That's valid. Sometimes it's because they don't know what to do. Okay, that's valid. Well, then let's get them trained. Sometimes it's because they've been bullied before and they sure as heck don't want to be bullied again. Valid. Yeah. Sometimes it's because they're busy at work and maybe they have a sick parent at home or a sick child at home, or maybe they're sick, maybe they have cancer, you know, and that's valid. So let's make a space for them to process their valid story, get some support, develop a strategy that's unique and best for them, safe for them, because at the end of the day, we want them to do the right thing. But yeah, we need support. They shouldn't be carrying shame and guilt around as well. That's not going to help anybody. That's going to make them sick. Cycle just continues. So let's make it safe for them to process that and develop a plan that works for them.
Yeah.
Because we need them. We need them.
Yeah. And I think it's about culture. It's about creating culture of kindness within the workplace, that this is just how we are. As opposed to, and when that becomes for everyone, when that becomes the way of being, it's much easier than to say, are you okay? Is everything all right? Gosh, do we want to do this differently? And it doesn't always have to be a face-on challenge. It can just be a segueing into, do we want to come at this in a different way? Because my own research has led me to, when I've looked at bystanding, I've really understood it as a rational, sometimes quite a rational decision for whatever is going on, like you've described in someone else's perspective. But for the person suffering, it's very difficult to understand that in the moment, you know. So there are all of these broken relationships. It's not just with the person who's, and I'm doing this with my hand up and down as if it's hierarchical. It's not always, and we know that. I've just found myself doing that and catching myself. But that piece around the broken relationships that can go around it, that need to be just mended and can be, I think.
Well, like I said to you earlier, when I went through it, I hated the bystanders that didn't speak up, because they were social workers and they were psychologists, and they're obligated by an oath to prevent abuse, to report abuse, but they watched it and they didn't do anything. But then after I started to heal, I realized, well, they had some wounds of their own, right? Like one social worker, MSW, I knew, she had a fear of conflict because of her childhood growing up in a domestic violence home. Well, then you have a responsibility to deal with your fear of conflict.
Yeah.
Especially if you're a master's degree social worker. And, you know, we see a lot of leaders that are not speaking up because they're afraid of conflict. Well, you're held to a higher level of accountability and responsibility. And the expectation is identify that you're a fear of conflict and go deal with it. You know, take a course, see a therapist, get a coach, get past it, because you can, but make that choice.
Yeah. And there's an importance of agency in the way that you're talking about us all having an individual agency to be our best selves in order to really be in a safe workplace, which I quite like. Yeah, yeah, I really like that.
And there's a piece tied into that as well, I think, with the having the language around this type of thing as well, because like what you said earlier, Linda, but I think it's an important point to say, because, you know, we're talking about it here, and both of you more so than me, but people who have spent time, you know, researching, writing, reading about these types of things. But my experience is, you know, a lot of people don't think of certain negative behaviors as actually having the potential effect that they can have. Or people think about bullying 9 times out of 10, they think about the children in the schoolyard rather than something that can happen at any stage of your life. So I suppose us talking about it here in the way that we are, we're coming from it from probably a different place than a lot of people are. And I think the point that you're making about people having the language and the exposure to that to develop what would then be their agency that you're referring to, Patricia. So I think there is an important step there as well.
Yeah, I agree with you. Absolutely, because this is a very subtle, very insidious form of abuse. You know, when you talk about harassment can be one incident, right? We can insult you because of your race or your size or your disability or, you know, sexual orientation and be charged with harassment on a one-time incident. But psychological harassment or bullying is never a one-time incident. And I often refer to it like death by a thousand cuts. Quote works really well. Because we always wonder, well, why am I injured by this? Just because they rolled their eyes at me. Well, it's not that. It's maybe the 600th time somebody's insulted you, or the 800th time, or maybe you're stubborn as me and waited till the 999th time. But eventually it brings anyone, doesn't matter how strong you are, how educated you are, or how articulate you are. If you've got a big target on your back and somebody's relentlessly targeting you, it'll eventually take anybody down.
Unless you
get support and education on this,
And I think the other thing we've noticed in our research has been around that sometimes it takes what we're calling denotive hesitancy. It takes a bit of time for it to click that it's actually happening. So we sort of make justifications, or we brush it off because we think, oh, they're having a bad day, or this is, you know, or I'm having a bad day, or but it takes a bit of time for it to register. Actually, there's a pattern here, and I'm beginning to really not want to go to work every day because I'm dreading meeting that person, or and so you're a bit further into it than you would like to be when you finally have to figure out that it's time you have to do something. And that's one of the hard things about this.
You make a very important point there that even that early sign that you just noticed there were signs before that. And I would say, trust your gut. If it doesn't feel good, trust it, make a note about it. And then if another incident, you just doesn't feel good, trust your gut, make a note of it. And then you'll see that pattern even earlier. So
I think that's really good advice. Just listen to yourself intuitively, the pain in your stomach or the headache that's coming, or just that anxiety piece, and just keep noting. So that you can then figure out, oh, if you look back with reflection, you can see something's stopping me being my full self here. I'm beginning to manage how I'm presenting myself to other people, or because I'm afraid of the kickback that I'll get, you know. Because some of our work has looked at one of our papers is on what we called the dark side of school culture. We talked about the staff room cliques and the culture stuff and the... and it's a highly downloaded paper. We're kind of floored at the thousands of downloads this paper has got, but it captures some of that, those death by a thousand cuts pieces that you don't realize until even the jokes at your expense constantly, until you realize actually I'm the only butt of these jokes. There's a problem.
I kind of changed that quote to psychological injury by a thousand psychological insults.
For sure.
Because there can be a rationalizing around these things, can't there? Like we kind of automate to that response sometimes. They're acting in this way because I did make that mistake last month, or maybe it was just a joke, or maybe am I too sensitive? Like, and that's the type of self-talk that can be there. But I think it's fantastic advice to just say, trust yourself, make a note of it, and then you can pick up in these signs earlier and earlier. I'm wondering, Linda, if you could tell us a little bit about the types of bullying that you've come across.
The types of bullying? You mean the types of bullies or the types of tactics?
Ooh, either or both. I want to hear it all.
I'm the same. I'm like, oh my God, let's do all of this.
I think most of us know the tactics. I mean, the rumors, the gaslighting, you know, the backstabbing, the sabotaging, the taking credit for your work and not giving you any credit, or... you know, just setting you up for failure, giving you impossible demands. Me, one of the patterns that's common is maybe on a Friday afternoon at 3:30, you get this project that is due now Monday at 9, meaning you're up all weekend, or maybe it's the beginning of your holidays. And I mean, the tactics go on forever and ever, you know, slamming the door in your face, finger in the face, calling you names, can be subtle, can be overt, covert. I mean, that stuff, I think most people know that stuff, you know, or giving you criticism under the guise of support.
Oh,
you know, I really like you. So I think you really need to know that everybody here doesn't like you. It's, whatever it is to rip you off of your psychological safety in the workplace, right?
Yeah.
But the types of bullies that I have seen are usually the ones that are not psychopaths, sociopaths, narcissists, because they will not come in, right? And there's nothing wrong with them. It's all your fault. So once there's an investigation and the employer wants to keep the respondent, they'll call me and send them to me on a mandatory basis. And if they don't show up, they're going to get terminated. So those ones show up. The psychopaths, sociopaths, they quit if they leave. So the ones that I do get to see are the ones that perhaps they were trained to be that way. They were trained to be authoritarian leaders. They were rewarded for it. They got promoted for it. Mm-hmm. They got bonuses for it. They got hired specifically because they were abrasive, specifically because they were incivil, because they were rude, because they had the capacity to be mean and not care. They were hired for that. And I mean, that was a very common leadership style for many, many years. That's no longer common anymore, of course, not accepted here, but that was one of them. And some of them have been doing it for decades. And, you know, often you hear targets get told that they're too sensitive. And I say, well, sensitivity never hurt anybody. It's the insensitivity that's hurting people. And these ones that have been getting away with this for years, well, I think, you know, they've developed this sort of thick callus between their heart and, you know, it's like this disengagement from their moral gauge, right? So they're disengaged from that, their old sense of self. And it's a matter of how holding them accountable. Number one, if they're substantiated as being bullies in the workplace or harassers, hold them accountable and force them to change. If you don't change, you get fired. So they have to come and see me. Then I get the investigation report. I get all the evidence. I get to learn their language of how they justify their behavior. And then, you know, you need somebody who knows what they're doing to connect all the dots in front of them, cut through all those layers of skin and get to that person. And you get to see this transformation because there's a lot of sobbing that takes place. A lot of, oh my God, I didn't get that. Nobody's ever confronted me like this. And that's true. Nobody ever has got through to them. And Laura Croshaw said the same thing. She does the same work as I do, working with respondents. And that's one type, you know, and I've seen some people that have never, ever worked before in their lives. And they have authoritarian leaders that trained them to be authoritarian, got away with it for 2-3 years, did really, really good. And then comes somebody and said, hey, you can't treat me that way. And I've got these two new leaders in my office that went, but that's the way I was told to do it. I didn't know I was causing harm. Mm-hmm. Both of them sobbing, both of them wanting to change. Others I've had suffer from a mental health issue that never got diagnosed. Okay. And it was simply getting them diagnosed and getting them treated. Others have suffered from addiction problems. And so it came to finally admit that the reason they targeted somebody in the work was because they were catching them at their drinking or catching them at their drug use. So they scapegoated them to get the attention on them. Others had some physical illness that caused them a great deal of pain and shame as well. And it was a matter of getting them a diagnosis and treatment, and also not having policies and procedures, not having HR available and being held responsible without HR. But there was all kinds of good reasons for this, like justifiable. Some of them just hadn't the soft skills. And there are some people that are in leadership positions that are on the autistic spectrum that can't develop that soft skill. And we can still get creative with them on how they can, you know, pretend to have soft skills. They don't have the capacity, but they can start to practice those skills, even though it's not coming from, you know what I mean? And and they're still successful at it. So I've seen many types. I've seen types that I wrote a couple down. I hope you don't mind if I refer to my notes, because
oh, please
yeah,
do.
Of course, yeah.
You've got some types that just come into the workplace like a bat out of hell, and they're just going to clean it all up, and they're they're not going to care. And that's the authoritarian, I think, that you've got people with 20 years of fantastic performance, and all of a sudden this bat out of hell comes in and is going to clean up, and now you're getting a negative performance appraisal, and it's like a shock, and you feel targeted after all these years of doing great. You've got others that are like narcissists that are, I mean, there's many people with narcissist traits out there, but suddenly there's a triggering moment. You know, somebody just suddenly called them out on something or made them feel inadequate, and boom, now you're a target because they're incredibly insecure as a leader. You've got some that just join the club because it's a whole lot easier to join the old boys club or the old girls club than it is to be at the outcast table with the ones that are being targeted. So it's just easier to join them. And then you've got some that pass the buck, just pass the buck and blame everybody else. And you've got some that were their friends are bullies, you know, like they don't want to be alone. So their friends are bullies. So they join them too, or they don't want to report their own friends. So they join them instead. And that's just a real moral dilemma right there. There's just all kinds of reasons, and they're valid reasons. And I think if you met some of them after they've transformed, you'd really like them. Especially one of mine is one of my favorite clients. Once we got past all the behaviors and found out what was underneath all that, he's my favorite client, to be honest.
I love this because it's a different way of talking about this. We usually were in a blame talk and unredeemable and as far away as possible, and they're absolutely terrible. Fire them and get rid of them, and that's the end of it. But you have, you know, you're living what that piece about all parties deserving kindness and deserving a chance to put things right. Love that. And that's an important piece that's maybe missing in our research at the moment from the academic side of the house, maybe less so from the practice side, which is something we need to catch up on. But there's something really important in what you're saying, I think.
Yeah, I did start writing a paper on this, so I'd love to talk to you more about that. Perhaps that's something you focus on. Yeah. But, you know, don't get me wrong, they're monsters when they're coming in. They're monsters. Yeah. Their behaviors are monstrous. But when we get through that therapy and we get through the coaching and the education, they are awesome people.
Yeah. You know, it's really, I read somewhere, and I don't know where I read it. It's really hard to bully someone, once you break through that sort of distance piece and you connect with someone, it's harder then to do the types of monstrous behaviors when you see the whole person as opposed to the employee that needs to do the job, you know? So there is that piece that you're talking about that's important. And the other that has struck me is about the development of the soft skills. And, you know, that you can perform them. You may not necessarily always get them from the heart, but you can perform them and make the place safe. I really believe in that too, actually.
Well, we did have to get creative, this one particular fellow. So when he was in his office, he could be his normal self. But when he walked through the door, you know, that emergency tape that's black and yellow for emergencies, we put that on the frame of his door so that it signaled him when he walked out of his office. He had to say, hi, how was your weekend? Yeah. You know, he had a nice little list of things that he had to do. But that was his signal. When he was back in his office, it could be his old black and white self. But when he walked through that door, he had to put on a little bit of warmth.
It's like the emotional labor piece. But, you know, we all do it in different ways in our lives anyway. So it's about bringing that more in a for a safety kind of climate in the workplace. I love that.
What really struck me when you were talking, Linda, is how everything can be justifiable. Can't it? And like, you know, for the individual, whether they genuinely believe it or not, I suppose, is a different thing. But every behavior can be justified for one reason or another. And I think that's feeding into your, like, by the individual themselves. I'm not saying looking at the outside in, it's right to do X, Y, or Z. That's not what I mean. But you can justify it yourself. And I think it feeds into, Patricia, what you're saying about looking at it in a different lens, that there's a piece as well about a lot of the conversation focuses on, I suppose, the victim of bullying, which of course, you know, rightly so, because of the extreme damage that they can face. But there is a piece, and it's the work that you're doing, Linda, about looking at the perpetrator and helping them to not do this to anyone else ever again. And so there's a balance in that conversation too, I think.
Well, everything I do is to help the target. So if we're helping standards, it's to help the target. If we're helping the perpetrators or the respondents or the bullies or whatever we want to call them, it's to help the target. It's to help create change. We can't create change without shining some light on all of these areas. And I just want to make one last point about the people that I work with. If they lack emotional intelligence, they lack self-insight. That's typical for a true bully, right? Lacking self-insight. Yeah. I truly think the solution is for all parties to develop emotional intelligence, to have self-insight, to know your own triggers, to watch your own behavior, to know what's going on, to trust yourself. Honestly, if bullies had some of self-insight, they wouldn't be doing what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, there's denial is a powerful thing. So we have to make them accountable, get them out of denial, cut through all those excuses and justifications, mm-hmm. and get to the core, or else we won't see change.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a real it's a real challenge to roll up the sleeves and go in there. I can't imagine it's easy work. I could imagine it's exhausting and difficult. For you
it's
to do
the best work I do. It's the best. It really is. I like the challenge.
It's because you can see the difference, or what? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I was raised and bullied as a kid, and you know, I can challenge this stuff easy for me. And same with a couple of others that do this around the world. It's just one of the best jobs I have to see that kind of transformation. It's amazing.
Yeah. And can we ask you, because you do this work, then do you have an immunity cloak? Does it never come to you now that you're in this space?
I do appreciate that question, because the truth is, I still do get bullied. People attempt to still try and bully me, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And some hurt me deeper than others, to be honest. I'm still human. And so I do get conned now and then. And I have had people who call themselves anti-bullying specialists or psychological safety specialists that have stolen my work or stolen my contracts or, you know, said some nasty things as I'm doing my work. And I see it. And I have to say that the more that we work on our self-insight, the more that we work on our wounds, you know, if somebody hurts me, then I need to look and see, well, how did they get there? How did they manage to hurt me? Because that's something in me that might have been an insecurity or a self-doubt. So I need to look here, and I'm constantly looking here. And I think I'll be doing that till the last breath, right? We're always growing. We're always developing. So when I get hurt now, it's a lot less. It's a couple of hours maybe, rather than a couple of months or a couple of weeks. Yeah. It's a couple of hours. So my thoughts on that is that always be cautious and always have boundaries and don't just, you know, fall for the first, you know, great speech or the first, you know, it takes a while to really get to know somebody. And we really do need to have contracts to protect ourselves and to make sure that we're slowing things down to get to really know people.
Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that's really useful to hear. I know myself in my own journey, I would have always felt, being a researcher in this field, when I experienced it, I didn't want to say that it was happening, because I was saying that's just somebody that will be seen as somebody who researches the field, who's now on her own bandwagon saying that she's being. So I had all of this kind of rationalization as to why you couldn't name what was going on for you, but disempowered myself over and over again by thinking like that. So for researchers too in the field, there isn't an immunity cloak, not in my experience, and you can get really hurt. And and people will think because you've been through the journey or you're where you are that people won't take a go, but they may do for a variety of different reasons. So
as long as we have insecure people on the planet, we're going to have people trying to bully us, right? So job is to make sure we're as confident and our self-esteem is in a good place. But I agree with you, the academic bullying is quite prevalent and it's very, very difficult to navigate.
Yeah. It's I'm looking more and more, and when you see on different sites, social media sites, and in the research, it's growing and growing at the moment. Whether that's that people are becoming are coming forward more, or whether there's more of it happening, I haven't figured out yet. But it's becoming a hard sort of sector to work in for many academics, which is sort of contrary to that whole thing about academic freedom and that space to be able to be the public intellectual and do the work that you need to do. They're contrary to. It's interesting, isn't it?
So, it is. But I think, you know, we're getting back to what we were talking about. I mean, things have changed. The world is becoming more aware of workplace bullying, and it's coming. It's, in my opinion, anyway, it's coming out of the closet. It's no more, you know, like domestic violence and sexual assault that used to be in the closet because we blamed the victims there. I think we're getting a little bit more courageous that we're coming out of the closet, more talking about it, and more people are catching it. I mean, I think research used to say that if it's 6 months or over, then it's probably bullying. But now I would say 3 months or over because, you know, the awareness is out there. But we still have insecure people and very wounded people hanging shingles and saying they're workplace bullying specialists now, but they haven't done their healing work. Yeah. And that really concerns me because you're not putting the needs of the vulnerable people first, and you have to put their needs first. So you have to heal first.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I agree with that completely. And I was working with someone a good bit ago, and they wanted to do research in a field that they were they'd been hurt in. And I was saying, we need to burn the wood somewhere else first before we can actually go into this space, so that when you're present with these people, it's not going to trigger where you have been.
Fantastic.
And it was a great journey, a tough journey, but a really good journey, I think. And it's led to some really amazing scholarship as a result, but hard to do and courageous to do. I really admire them because it was courageous to say, right, I'm going to do it. And yes, I think I agree with you wholeheartedly. And that piece about bringing your full self because you've done your work, you know, it's a really important part of it. Yeah.
Well, we're going to be standing in front of audiences with you know, bullies, with targets, with witnesses, and they're all at different stages. And if you're wounded, you're going to be triggered all over the place. You're not going to neutral position, you're going to be very biased and you're going to cause more harm.
And I think we need to talk a bit more about that piece, but also I was listening to a keynote over the weekend from somebody who talked about an area of work that has a lot of trauma in it that he's researching, and he spoke just so openly about what it was doing to him. And at the end, that a colleague said, you need to take a break, you need to take a few months off, you know. And he was very, and then he took the break and he saw the impact that the work was having for him and what it was bringing up for him. So there is a piece around, it's not just doing the work on what has happened, but it's on what's currently happening as we're continuing to work with people. Because you can't but be moved. And you've described about how you feel about working with the clients, but you're moved by them and you're moved by their journey. They do, it does go in, you know, it does get in. So you have to do a bit of work on it.
Yeah. And I have to take my breaks too and do some. It comes, we're at risk in this work of vicarious trauma, right? We're at risk of compassion fatigue. We're at risk of burnout. And I have experienced all of those in the last 12 years. So there's times when I know that I'm reaching my level and I got to back away for a while.
Yeah.
And how do you do that then? What's your kind of reset?
And I highly recommend you write a book about that, Linda, too. Yeah. I'll be reading it.
Well, if I need to see a therapist, I'll see a therapist. If I need a weekend away in hiding in the mountains or whatever, I'll go do that. Or maybe just stay quiet and paint for a while, or, you know, go out and have some fun. But I need to sleep too, right? Yeah. A lot of sleep. But there's just times when I have to back out. But what I decided to do a couple of years ago is I couldn't keep up with the workload, and I decided to train other people to do what I do because there was so much work, and I needed to train trainers. And I needed to train therapists. I needed more therapists trained on how to treat this injury because I was seeing some mistakes being made. And then I realized I needed to train investigators because they're not trauma informed. Mm-hmm. So that would prevent people from coming to me because they're injured during an investigation. So I started to train different professions on this trauma informed perspective so that we would see a decrease in the harm. Yeah.
I love what you're saying there because you're really meeting yourself where you're at and what you need in that time. When we're talking about reaching that burnout and fatigue, or do I need a weekend of quiet in the mountains? Do I need to go painting? Do I need to, and I will do that. And then versus the workload is just becoming too much. What do I need to do in order to continue having this incredible impact, but in a manageable way and reach out more and then do that. So I think what you're saying there is really important. You're meeting, yeah, where you're at to move forward again.
Yeah. Well, it brought a lot of people on board because there's just mm-hmm. so much work to be done. We're not even touching the tip of the iceberg. Yeah. It's been 12 years. So there's a lot more to be done. So, you know.
And you're in the middle of global reach. I'm going to use that phrase because the World Workplace Bullying Awareness Week is happening in October. But you're sort of a keen proponent of this, and you're a huge advocate, and you're getting us all thinking about it and getting us all connected. So tell us a bit about that work. I think it would be good for people to hear a little.
I'll give credit to Gary Namy because he started the Freedom from Workplace Bullying Week long before I started Workplace Bullying Awareness Week. So I jumped on the same week as him and I called it Workplace Bullying Awareness, and it was just something I did for Canada. And then all of a sudden, I think Judy was the first one to jump on board, and I realized, you know, we need to invite other countries. So about 5 years ago, I started inviting other countries, and now we have 16 countries that, and I hope this year we get a whole lot more countries that just join in that week. And it's a week of events. You know, you just do whatever you want to do in your country. Definitely develop a poster that says, you know, Workplace Bullying Awareness Week in Ireland, Workplace Bullying Awareness Week in India, wherever you are, and put your own sort of image on. It's not a marketing ploy. It's more about a week of awareness. Let's get together on Zoom and talk. Let's do some podcasts, radio interviews. Let's give some tip sheets away. Mm-hmm. Here's some research that you might want to read. Just every day, somebody putting something up on social media or offering it in your own city or your own town where you can build awareness. Everybody gets really creative. You know, we've done some lovely poetry where everybody says a line in different countries, or we've rewritten songs and we join together and just tries to make this a worldwide voice so that that's a worldwide solution, because it is happening worldwide, right?
Yeah. And I think connecting people just internationally too, it gives you a piece that's broader than yourself. That you can see, okay, it's not me, there's other people here, but there's other people around the world. So I'm not alone in this. And there's a solidarity in that too that helps healing, I think, is to have that sense that it's taking it out of just you and into a shared space.
That's exactly the purpose. And last year I shined a little bit of light on New Zealand, because New Zealand was really struggling and still is. New Zealand is really behind in a lot of us compared to a lot of us. And I was hoping that, you know, this year we would shine a light on Malaysia. And I was trying to get some speakers to come from Malaysia because I think they're struggling too. But I like to try and pick a country that's struggling, that's behind us, and that it doesn't have any knowledge of this, and just give attention to them. So we try to get a different theme every year and just help the world out.
So have you plans going forward? What are you currently working on that might be of interest to people to hear about?
Well, there's a lot happening. So the Canadian Institute of Workplace Harassment and Violence is a very new organization. That's a not-for-profit organization. And I started that just about a year ago, because a lot of my clients from the for-profit organization, the Canadian Institute of Workplace Bullying Resources, were coming to me and they were running out of funds. They weren't able to get money to get healed, and they didn't have the money to ask for a legal consult. And I saw that as another injustice. Mm-hmm. Here you're injured and you're trying to navigate this very complex systems. We need to do something. So I started this not-for-profit, and we have our first big fundraiser in Toronto, Ontario in October 20th. And the whole premise of this organization is to raise funds to help people get some treatment or a legal consult. I believe that, you know, maybe 25% of employees in Canada that are getting bullied are coming forward. If we gave them some resources, we might see that climb to 60 or 70%, which means more noise, more attention on this issue, forcing change, forcing our governments to get more teeth in the legislation, right?
Yeah.
So that's a board that's just started, and our big fundraiser is October 10th, 20th, and we're advertising that to try and get some money. Next year, I think our fundraiser will be a conference on workplace safety. So we'll keep trying to do different things to help people that have already exhausted their savings. And I mean, I know clients that exhausted their life savings, lost their houses, just trying to do the right thing and stand up for themselves. That's just terrible. They need some help.
Yeah.
So we're in the midst of doing that. And then focusing on Workplace Bullying Awareness Week, doing a different projects. But I am trying to get more therapists trained. I am trying to get more people available for people around the world so that you've got a good skill set and you're not unintentionally causing them more harm. Like, for example, a therapist that starts, when you walk into a therapist's office and you're traumatized and scared to death, they're not going to believe you. Scared to death, they're going to think you're crazy. Scared to death, they're going to blame you. The last thing you should do as a therapist to start off with CBT. You know, don't start with cognitive behavioral therapy. That's a mistake right there. You know, so there's some things some therapists really need to know. So I'm just really trying a lot of training because I intend to be very, very, there's a couple of projects coming that I can't talk about yet, but I'm going to be very, very busy and I'm not going to be able to do what I do now. So I want to get a good platform and a really good network around the world, actually, of therapists and coaches and investigators that get them trauma informed.
Especially for the investigators, those at the coal face who are walking into a room for people who are decimated and who need support to get their message across. It mightn't come across as clearly because there's so much pain and emotion there as well. But even just that piece that those investigators and that they have that trauma piece so that they can get in underneath and be able to do it in a safe way is huge. I mean, that's groundbreaking. So yeah, I would really admire that work.
The topic of investigations is a whole nother book.
I mean, it is.
There needs to be a regulatory body that ensures that investigators are trained on the basics and held accountable. Like, you can't just do willy-nilly investigations on these psychological cases, you know, like, and we're seeing a lot of that. Mm-hmm. And the investigators are causing more problems. So, you know, you can't just hire a lawyer to do it when they don't have any trauma-informed. You can't just hire a retired police officer to do investigations because they don't have trauma-informed training. They're making a lot of mistakes out there, and a lot of investigators are not licensed. They should be licensed because then they have liability insurance. So if you're a leader or an employer out there, make sure your investigator is licensed because that lawsuit is going to be on you.
Yeah.
If your investigator makes a mistake.
But also the financial support to be able to defend yourself, to go and get that help because I think sometimes people will feel maybe they don't need that help, or it's a step too far, or it's too formal to go and get some legal advice, when actually they should be in the door of that much earlier in order to support them how they navigate the system. One of the challenges that I think about the system, the policy piece, you know, it's fantastic to develop policy, but policy can also push so much underground. And if you don't come within the policy, even though it could be an ordinate bullying, if it's not described here in these pages, it doesn't count. And there's so many issues with the organizations just protecting themselves by saying, we followed procedure. Okay, there's blood on the floor, but we followed procedure, so we're okay here. You know, that there's a lot of work that we need to do in that space as well.
Completely negating the human experience,
exactly.
Right? So,
yeah.
No, the follow procedure means they don't know what they're doing, in my opinion.
And protecting themselves in the process, I think, is the other side of it. So it's we'll follow procedure, and here's the phone number of an employee assistance counselor who'll be able to help you as you fall on the floor, because we're just going to follow our procedure and leave you out there, sort of stuff.
EAP's not necessarily trained in this area. You know, that's short-term solution-focused, and solution-focused therapy is not going to help anybody who's being bullied because it's longer than short-term, you know, solution-focused. So there's a problem right there.
Yeah.
But are they really committed to solving the problem? You know, like, leaders and employers need to realize that the employees are watching you. They're seeing if you walk your talk, right? And your policies might be beautiful and your websites might be beautiful about psychological safety, but are you walking your talk?
Yeah.
Are you practicing what you preach? Because if you're not, you're going to have employees either follow your lead and not practice what your policies preach, or they're just not going to trust you and they're not going to respect you and they're not going to stay around. So it's just a piece of paper at the end of the day if you're not following it.
Yeah. And there's a spirit to policy, not just this is the piece that I'm concerned about. There should be a spirit to this is the ethos and this is the culture and these are the ethics through which we work. And that should be as loud as just the words on the page. Does it tick a particular box, you know? So
leaders set the tone of a work environment. You know that. Leadership sets the tone. So leaders need to really take a good look at what tone are they want to set. And they need to make sure that their entire leadership team, from the lowest level of leadership right to the very top, is a cohesive team. They're all on the same page. Zero tolerance is zero tolerance.
Yes.
If you've got a couple of leaders that don't buy into that, you've got weak links, it destroys all your effort.
Yeah. But I think there's a distinct lack of courage about zero tolerance. I just think there just is. A courage piece about calling it out to say this isn't appropriate behavior. And actually, if that's modeled early, it cuts through so much. That's the leadership piece. That requires a courageous leadership piece, that sometimes people are afraid that they'll be hung out if they do it, if they're in the middle leadership piece, that they won't get the backup to do it or whatever. But these are bigger, complicated conversations. Well, but they're certainly part of the dynamic, I think.
There's research out there that shows 70 to 75%, depending on which research paper you're reading, the bullying is top down. And that tells us that we are not setting leaders up for success. Mm-hmm. We are not putting in people in positions of power that are competent, that are confident, because confident, competent leaders don't bully.
Yeah.
So if we set them up for success, hire them because of merit, don't hire them because they're your friend and you owe them a favor, you know, that kind of thing, or nobody else wants the job, so you plug somebody in it. Don't be doing that, because you're going to be setting somebody up to be secure in their position. So set people up for success, hire them for merit, train them, mentor them, give them coaches if they have some areas of weakness, like they're afraid of conflict, but also monitor them and hold them accountable. Mm-hmm. And we'll get rid of that 70%, which means the rest won't be tolerated. You know, so if you've got somebody bullying bottom up, in my opinion, that's a leadership problem.
Yeah.
So we set leaders up for success, we won't be seeing this. So I say leading with emotional intelligence, your feet should be in the cement of leading with emotional intelligence. That should be your base.
Yeah.
And then you should have a toolbox of all kinds of different leadership styles. But number one, you should know your leadership style. Most don't. But it should be cemented in emotional intelligence.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Wholeheartedly agree. So I would describe from talking to you that you are a thought leader and a leading practitioner in this area. It's an absolute pleasure to talk to you, I must say. We do ask some questions. Our first question is really a leader who inspires you and why. We have a three sort of rapid fire, but they're not so rapid type question. A leader who inspires you and why?
I would have to say Brené Brown would be my first inspiration when I was very wounded and very insecure and lost and confused and didn't understand shame and didn't have the courage to speak up. Her books came out right at that time, right? Yeah. So I started reading, you know, Daring Greatly and all her books, and I related to her, and I found my voice through her. And I actually met her at a conference in Washington, D.C., where she spoke. And what I liked about her is she's very authentic. Mm-hmm. She doesn't have to be perfect. You know, she'll show up and say, I'm a mess today. And she'll talk about that and be really real. And for me, that really resonates for me. I just want to be real. I don't want to be up there like I'm, you know, lights and camera and talking a good talk. I want to walk my talk. I want to admit I make mistakes. I want to admit that I'm not perfect. I've hurt people in my life. And I love that about her. And so there are times when I might have had to speak in front of an audience where I might have been a little bit triggered by something, and I'll channel Brené Brown.
Love that.
I'll just be honest with my audience. You know, oops, I just got knocked off my kilter there. I'm back. And then I'll be back on again, you know, so.
Yeah. I think she's very empowering. I think that realness that you've described, there's just so much in what she has to say as well that just touches the heart of how we are in our world, our vulnerabilities, our fears, our strengths. So I'm a huge fan as well. I just think it's incredibly empowering. For when you're thinking, am I doing this okay? And the imposter syndrome, she gets a bit kicked off when you listen to Brené Brown. So I think that's pretty cool.
But yeah. I think that it also makes you probably more effective as well, isn't it? Because you're not playing the game of pretending, you know, everything is going right 100% of the time, that you always know the answers, that, you know, that type of thing. And you can't, you know, you can't, particularly when we're talking about leadership, you can't lead in a way that's not you. Do you know, you mm-hmm. can't, or you can't park yourself totally and say, you know, everything in my life and everything that goes on in my head is completely separate to this role. You know, you bring you and your emotions with you. Yeah. So it's, yeah, I think it makes you more effective as well.
I agree. Yeah. I think I have a good core sense of myself. And I think she does too, a good core sense of who I am. Mm. And I think that's why some people try to bully, you know, because insecure bullies or imposter syndrome bullies, they can't get that. They can't take that from you. They don't like that in you, that you've got a core sense of who you are. I don't have to pretend or be a chameleon. I don't have to be a chameleon. I can just be me. And I think they're triggered by that.
Yeah. And I do think that when you lead out from the heart, just authentic self, it's actually a protection in the world. It might make you vulnerable to this sort of stuff coming at you, but it's actually what gets you out of too. It's what keeps your core and gets you back to yourself. So I think they try and pull it from you, but the most important thing is to hold on to it, in my view. Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
And the next thing we have for you, Linda, is there anything that you would do differently looking back on your own journey?
Yes.
How long do we have?
Yes, I would. I mean, you'll have to remember at the time it was my mother was dying, so I was grieving. I'd lost her, there was a lot of complications about her death, so that was going on. So I was vulnerable, and there was nobody talking about this. There was no resources, so there was no help for me. So I wish I could go back and, first of all, heal more about my grief, because I put that off and I became hypervigilant instead. And secondly, I think I would, I believe I took every layer of fight that I could. I went through every system, but I didn't have confidence, right? Because nobody else was there to say, Linda, you're doing the right thing. This is right. So I didn't take it all the way. I wish now I had sued the pants off of them, because I'd probably be so much, you know, like I would have won the case. I know that without a doubt. I had all kinds of evidence, but I had a crappy union rep who set me up and terrible HR people who were bullies themselves. But I wish now I'd had the courage I have today and go back and fight, because I don't want every one of them. I don't want every fight. I did win every fight, but I didn't get anything out of it. I ended up quitting to save my life. And sometimes you have to quit to save your life.
For sure.
Quit a job you love.
Yeah.
But I wish I could go back and fight, because I know I'd have won every single one of them.
Yeah.
So I hope I can help people get that today.
I think, and that's huge. I think that's the piece. It's about knowing, having the courage. It's so frightening to take that on at the time, especially when there aren't people who are experienced behind you saying, you know what, this is really clear and go for it. So what you're offering in return forward. It's interesting when you're looking back, what you're doing going forward is certainly healing for that piece about not going back, you know. So
very satisfying, very rewarding. I get my justice this way. There's many ways to get justice, but I mean, it's nobody has to go through this alone today.
It's really interesting also, if I could just, and I don't want to take away from the questions piece, but the two pieces you've spoken about, the lack of support from HR and the sort of ineffective union rep, that's just textbook across a million stories of this. It's the one thing that comes out absolutely everywhere. And the lack of understanding of colleagues around HR who learn the hard way that HR's job is to protect the organization, you know, and that's the piece. You know, there's a rhetoric versus practice piece there.
Yeah,
and they're very painful injuries on top of painful injury, I think.
You know, we're talking about institutional betrayal there. That's an internal systems betrayal right there. Yeah. But I mean, I've met HR people that are absolute bullies, absolute, yes. And, you know, I get my defenses up when I hear that abrasive tone and that, you know, sort of dominating tone. But I've also met some amazing HR people that have done the very best to stand up and end up getting bullied and getting tortured. And, you know, they're just good people. And so they're like in a sandwich, right? There's leadership and they're in a tough place. Nobody trains them on this or gives them, at the end of the day, they need their paycheck too. Automatically, I say that HR shouldn't be doing investigations because there's an automatic bias there too.
And I think those that try really hard, and I've met some amazing people in that space who are caught in a bigger system and yet at the same time advocating and trying to find as many solutions to support people as they can. That's not an easy station, actually. That takes its own toll on their health, and I've seen it happen. So and they can get a backlash too sometimes for trying to. So that's a rough one. I wouldn't want to be there, I have to say.
A lot of HR people are leaving and becoming private practice consultants, right?
Yeah.
So
you can
don't blame them.
So a piece of advice that you would give to someone starting out on their leadership journey, just say if they want to go into a middle leadership role or a senior leadership role, and now with the knowledge and experience that you have, what advice would you give them?
Well, first I would say, self-assess. What is your leadership style? What do you aspire to be as a leader in your style? And take a really good course on leading with emotional intelligence. And that's going to open doors like you can't even perceive right now what that would even open doors to, because you're going to be doing a lot of work on yourself. And so a competent, confident leader doesn't bully. So if that's what you want to be, then go and take emotional intelligence. Secondly, I would say, don't assume you know what this topic of workplace bullying or psychological harassment. Don't assume you know, because I promise you, there's more for you to learn, and you will be more effective if you take a very broad, trauma-informed, holistic perspective training, not just tick the box on it. You will be one who will be very successful if you take those two pieces of training, because that's the way of the future. That is the world we're going to. You might as well get on board there. And on that side of this change, I wouldn't want to be on the other side.
So
if you're just starting out, I would be getting those two things under your belt.
I love that. And they're a prevention. They're almost like a creative way of working, so that you can never end up in that place, which you know, hopefully would happen. It's really good advice, I would think.
Yeah, prevention and early intervention. You know, you know what, you don't want to know how to intervene properly, or you don't want to get to a crisis level. So and then you can help with repair and recovery too.
Yeah, because sometimes things can be fixed early. If something's happening between colleagues, and if you're the lead, something can be fixed, just tweaked a little bit earlier that cuts off all of the stuff that happens through chat and gossip and rumor and all the various things that that we start to do as human beings. But the leadership piece in that can cut. That's about setting culture, which you said earlier, they set the tone. If you get in early, you can prevent some of that. Good advice for people. So,
Linda, it's been an absolute pleasure. It's been amazing to have you join us. And we're very much looking forward to engaging with the workplace bullying awareness events that are happening in Ireland as well.
For sure.
So we'll definitely be connecting again over that. But thank you so much for giving us the time. It's been amazing.
Great conversation. Thank you for having me.
That's great. So we're hoping we'll connect again soon. Maybe we'll talk a bit offline and connect again, and we'll definitely see each other over the week, where we're talking a lot more about raising this type of awareness. And just heartfelt congratulations to you on being a leader in this space, because you are so needed. And please keep doing it. And please keep training people. And because I wish I'd had it when I needed it. And I'm just really delighted to see someone like you is doing this work.
Yeah, making the world a better place, for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, thank you. And thank you for the research you're doing. And I'm looking forward to reading some of it. Thank you.